Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group podcast. The following podcast was co-hosted by the Federalist Society's Intellectual Practice Group and George Mason University School of Law's Center for the Protection of Intellectual Property. It was recorded on Tuesday, May 21st, 2013, during a live telephone conference call. Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group telephone conference call. Today, we're going to be discussing in detail Bowman versus Monsanto, the patent seed case decided last week in the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please take note that the opinions expressed today are those of the experts on our call, and also we're recording the call for possible use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're very pleased to welcome to our program a panel of three experts and a guest moderator. We're going to hear opening remarks from each of them, including our moderator, of about 7 to 10 minutes, after which they'll have a little discussion, and then we'll get to questions from the audience. Our moderator today, who's going to introduce the panelists, is Professor Sean O'Connor from the University of Washington School of Law. As always, the bios for all our participants are available on our website and in the notice of today's call. So with that, Professor O'Connor, please go right ahead with the program.
Great. Thank you, Dean. I think we're going to have a great session today. I appreciate everyone calling in to listen to our session today. We're going to have, besides myself as moderator, we're going to have George Contreras, who's a professor of law at American University in Washington, D.C., Professor Greg Dolan, who's a law professor at University of Baltimore, and Hans Sauer, who is the general counsel for Biotech Industry Organization, usually known as BIO. I'm going to set up the case, give a little bit of background about it, and then turn it over to our panelists, who will then give their opinions and insights into the case. After that, then we will be able to go into a discussion session. So the background of the case is that these are genetically engineered soybeans that are at issue. They're genetically engineered so that they resist the Roundup herbicide that Monsanto produces. So Monsanto has produced both seeds, soybean seeds, beans, and an herbicide. When the soybean plants grow, you can spray the Roundup on them, and it will only kill the weeds around them and not the soybean plants themselves. Obviously, this is incredibly valuable for farmers. In the normal course of things, Monsanto sells what we'll call the first generation seeds, the genetically engineered seeds, to farmers to plant. These are the Roundup ready seeds. When it sells the seeds to the farmers, it includes with them a technology license. And this license says to the farmer that the beans can only be planted once, and any of the beans that grow out of that first generation soybean can only be sold for feed, cannot be replanted. So let's call the beans that come out of those first-generation seeds the second-generation seeds. The second-generation seeds, the harvest of the first-generation seeds, are generally sold to grain elevators. And in the grain elevators, then they're sold as commodities in the normal course of business for soybeans. Because keep in mind, again, that the seeds just are the beans. They're the same thing. Once you have second-generation soybeans, the ones that are in the grain elevators, it is possible to replant those because, again, they are just seeds. So you could plant those, and then you could create another generation of soybeans, and we'll call those third generation. The farmer in this case, Bowman, had bought seeds, first generation seeds from Monsanto, and planted those and sold the harvest off to grain elevators. That's not what the case is actually concerned about. Instead, what Bowman also did was he bought second-generation seeds out of the grain elevators. So why did he do this? He did this because the first-generation seeds are sold at a premium because they're genetically engineered and they have all these great attributes. And the point, again, is that you are using them for growing soybeans and then selling them as commodities. The second-generation seeds that are in the grain elevators are sold at commodity prices. So Bowman realized that if he could buy those seeds, and rather than just using them as feed or using them for any other regular purposes, consumption purposes, he could then plant those. Now, he knew that since the second generation seeds were mixed in the grain elevators with conventionally grown soybeans, not genetically engineered soybeans, that he'd have a mixed bag, literally, of seeds. So when he planted them, and he did this in his late harvest, because that was the riskier planting time, he then would see which plants would survive after he sprayed the whole crop with Roundup. The ones that survived, he knew, must be Roundup-ready seeds. So he kept those and then replanted them in subsequent years. So essentially what he believed he had done was he had gotten around the technology license and the patent restrictions on the first generation seeds, because the seeds he bought out of the grain elevator were not ones that he had purchased directly from Monsanto, and so they did not come along with the technology license. He also believed then that because of the doctrine of patent exhaustion, that these seeds that he had purchased, again, with no restrictions on them, as far as he was concerned, then could be freely reused in the normal course of how soybeans could be used. So he did this after a number of such harvests. Monsanto realized what was going on, sued him for patent infringement. He defended on patent exhaustion basis. The district court rejected his argument. It went up to the Federal Circuit, who affirmed the district court's opinion. It came up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court affirmed on the largely the same basis that the Federal Circuit had decided upon. So the Supreme Court's decision, I'm going to not say a lot about it because the question of exactly what they said is something that I want our panelists to opine about. But at the most general level, the Supreme Court has told us that patent exhaustion applies only to the thing sold. And so in this case, it would be the first generation seeds when you bought them from Monsanto, but also under the Supreme Court's view, the second generation seeds. And then exhaustion is done at that point. And so anything that comes out of those seeds that were purchased, so the subsequent generations of seeds, are not exhausted. Patent exhaustion does not apply to them. And so anyone trying to use those subsequent generation of seeds has to then have a license to do so. Bowman also argued that he was just using the soybeans in the normal course, the way farmers do, and so that this should override any sense of the license attaching to it, and that the patent should be exhausted. The Supreme Court instead holds that his decision, his opinion about this, would be the exception to the exhaustion rule and would not be the normal exhaustion rule. So the questions then, before I now turn it over to our panelists, are trying to get a sense from the Supreme Court's decision here about where exactly exhaustion does end in this chain of events leading from seeds to plants and to more seeds, and where does the license actually start, or what part does the license cover? Second issue is what's the proper analogy in the case? The Supreme Court cites a number of earlier cases, including the Quanta decision and Univis decision. And so both of them say some things about exhaustion, and which one of those really, or of any of the other cases cited, really kind of provides the best model for what's going on with Bowman and Monsanto seeds. And then a final issue that we may get to if the panelists are interested or so inclined is a question that people have been wondering about for a while, which is a old decision called Mallinckrodt, and this was a story about a case about having conditioned sales. And people have wondered whether that case survived the Quanta decision and now whether it survives this decision. Okay, so with that basic setup now, I want to start turning it over to our panelists. So our first panelist again is George Contreras, Professor of Law at American University. George, I'll hand it over to you.
Yeah. Sean, thanks very much. So that was a great summary. Appreciate that, and I won't repeat what Sean has explained to us. And I have to admit that I certainly don't disagree with the Supreme Court's rationale in the case. It was a 9-0 decision. They were fairly unanimous. They were absolutely unanimous in the decision, and I think that in this case it was decided correctly. But I do have some questions and concerns about the way the opinion was written and what implications it might have for future cases. And, you know, so as Sean alluded, the Justice Kagan's decision was really based primarily on the notion of making a new generation of seeds. And this came out quite a bit in the oral argument. Yes, Bowman certainly had the right to take his seeds that he got from the elevator, use them for animal feed, consume them, do a number of other things with them, but using them to grow a new generation was actually infringing the right to make that next set of seeds, which infringed one of the exclusive rights of Monsanto, the patent holder. And so the focus on making, I think, is right in the case, but there was another tact that Bowman, I think, tried to take and tried to take unsuccessfully that I think is worth thinking about a little bit more, and that is use. So Bowman, throughout his argument, perhaps, you know, in not the not the most consistent way, but throughout his argument, talked about using the seeds that he acquired in the normal course, that he planted seeds and did, you know, what you generally do with seeds, just plant them, and they grew of their own accord into these new plants. And the court didn't buy that argument. But there's an analogy that didn't come out too much in the arguments that I think about when I think about this sort of scenario, and that is a machine. We certainly have patented machines that produce things like widgets. You buy a patented widget-making machine, and the purchase of that machine typically implies the right to use it to make widgets. Make those widgets, sell them, use them, whatever you would do with widgets. And yes, the sale of that first widget machine could, in fact, eliminate the total market for widgets down the road. This is one of the fears that Justice Kagan mentions in the opinion. But that's okay. If there is a purchaser of a widget machine who has the capacity to supply the world's widget supply with that first machine, then yes, that's a consequence of the implied license that you have to make those infringing widgets. So why isn't a seed basically a seed-making machine? Right? I mean, genetically speaking, that's what a seed is. It's intended by nature to produce more seeds. And, you know, it strikes me that Bowman could have argued that it's okay to make those additional seeds because that's in the nature of seeds. It's like the lens blanks in the Univis case, which this court also cites, which says that when you sell lens blanks that have no purpose other than making finished lenses, there's an implied license to make those finished lenses, even if you don't have an explicit license to the finishing process. So this argument didn't work in the Bowman case, and there are some reasons, right? The seeds have other uses, and these seeds in particular had uses other than planting, and Justice Kagan is very clear about that. Use them as grain feed, use them for food, and so forth. And she does something which is very interesting in a patent case, which is she talks about the intent of the parties, that the commodity soybeans he purchased were intended not for planting, but for consumption. And she takes that from some of the testimony a trial. And it's curious that intention has actually become important now in patent law. This is not a willful infringement analysis. This is something different. This is whether there's infringement to begin with. Talking about intention of the parties is peculiar. We also want to talk about intention in this case because there is a risk of innocent infringement. This was brought up in the argument, and the case wasn't really addressed in the opinion. In fact, the court sidesteps the question of what happens if there are windblown seeds that are patented but grow in your yard through no fault of your own, self-replicating technology and so forth, seeds, bacteria, and so forth. You know, I guess one question to ask is whether there's a need for an innocent infringement defense in patent law that's occasioned by the rise of self-replicating technology, which never existed before. And then in conclusion, I will briefly touch on the Mallinckrodt decision that Sean mentioned, because it was thought after the Quanta case in 2008 that Mallinckrodt was basically dead. Mallinckrodt, which tried to impose single-use restrictions on medical devices, even though they were sold to a hospital, then later re-sterilized by a third party and then resold to the hospital. Those types of restrictions are frowned upon in the Quanta case in 2008. Many speculated that Mallinckrodt and these post-sale restrictions were dead. But in this case, the court does look with some favor on Monsanto's license agreement. The restriction that is imposed in the license agreement to only plant the seeds, make one subsequent crop from them. The court is sidestepping the question of Mallinckrodt at the oral argument. A couple of the justices, including Justice Kagan and Justice Sotomayor, asked the parties whether they were being asked essentially to overrule the conditional sale doctrine. They were not, but it would have been nice to have some better clarity about whether that happened or not, particularly not just for seeds, but for other industries like printer cartridges, which are patented, which are sold with restrictions on and prohibitions on refilling and recycling that actually have been in litigation. I think the Supreme Court recently denied cert on that case, or one of those cases as it was making its way through the courts. So I think that new life has been breathed into Mallinckrodt by this case. I think there is a specter of intentionality that has crept into this analysis that's going to be worth more consideration. And as a result of that, I think that the possibility of an innocent infringer defense, which we have never really had in patent law, becomes a real possibility. So anyway, with those thoughts, I guess I will turn it over to Greg Dolan.
Thanks, George, and thank you, Sean, and again, thanks for having me here. It's always a pleasure. I want to recapitulate everything that's been said before, but I will, I guess, take my 7 minutes or so to respond to some of George's comments. And I suppose let me begin with sort of the innocent infringement idea. And I was sort of thinking about it as I was walking to work today, because traditionally, of course, patent infringement is a strict liability offense, and innocent infringement has never been a defense. And so in some ways, it would seem somewhat odd to craft this sort of exception onto the patent law that is not statutorily contemplated and has never been part of our law. Now, to be fair, George is right that technology didn't exist to create an opportunity for innocent infringement. The self-replicating technology is a novel thing. And so what occurred to me is perhaps the notion is not that it's about innocent infringement, but that in patent law and traditionally sort of in tort law, in which the concept of strict liability infringement draws, even in strict liability cases, it involves a person doing something, sort of taking some sort of acts, or but conversely not taking some acts that he should have taken before incurring any liability. Now, the person may be careful and may be doing sort of everything right, but he still must be participating in some sort of activity. And if it's true that there can be a situation where seeds simply blow onto somebody else's land without that person doing particularly much of anything, and they end up growing on that land, that may be it's the lack of activity and not necessarily sort of the innocence of the person that ultimately should govern the lack of liability. Let me then move on to sort of to the comments about use. Why isn't a seed making machine? I think ultimately Justice Kagan got it right, and the court got it right in that if that were sort of even if Bauman were to be in a better position to press that argument, The problem with that argument and with this specific technology is that it completely undermines the patent. Because if that was sort of the view the courts were to take, essentially Monsanto would be able to sell one seed and one seed only. And then from that, you know, more seeds could be grown and everybody else could go into competition with Monsanto, however many people choose to buy the second, third, fourth, and fifth generation seeds. And that is certainly not what was contemplated by the patent. In other scenarios, one would be able to have a patent on a machine or on a method of producing something and a method on sort of the ultimate widget that's produced. Here, I think George is right that it's one and the same. The machine is the same as the widget, and so the seed, and therefore you can't have multiple patents covering it. But I think the converse of that is that the argument that this seed is simply a seed-making machine, and so once you sell the machine, you should also be held to exhaust your rights to the widget. I think in this case, that doesn't really hold. In some ways, I must say that having read the opinion when it came out, I'm somewhat surprised that the court even granted cert on it. It was such a short and almost dismissive opinion, with no dissents, no concurring views. It was it took the court all of 10 pages to dispense with Bauman's argument, and sometimes even in a tongue-in-cheek fashion, when sort of Justice Kagan wrote that we don't buy the quote blame the seed argument. That it's somewhat peculiar the court that has fairly strict rules on what kind of case it will take it, that, you know, based on its importance and split of the circuits below or and other factors, that it even took this case. And so it's somewhat it seems somewhat odd to me that they did, unless of course they thought that the case was going to talk about focus more on patent licensing and then ultimately on the facts of the case. Licensing itself was not an issue. And so, which leads me to my next point about, would this case have come out differently had Monsanto not put a restrictive license on the use of the seed? If Monsanto simply sold the seed to the farmers, and then the farmer and Bauman had saved second and third generation seeds to keep replanting them even outside of the restrictive license situation. And it seems to me that that's the case should have, I don't know if it would have, but I think it should have come out the same. Because ultimately, by saving the seeds and replanting them and growing more seeds, ultimately I think Bauman is creating and making more. So he has a right to do whatever he wishes with the first generation seeds. The patent is exhausted as to those seeds, in my view. He can sell them, he can use them, he can, you know, make food stuff out of it, he can feed them to his animals, but he's not or should not be able to make more from that one seed. Just like if you buy a car engine, you shouldn't be able to sort of to pick it apart, see how it's made, chisel your own parts of the engine, and then assemble another one. I don't see a meaningful difference between the two situations. So ultimately, I think the license here ended up being somewhat of a red herring, with the outcome, in my view, not particularly dependent on the license. And in my last thoughts, that's kind of ultimately leads me to the Mallinckrodt case. I don't have any particularly strong views on Mallinckrodt and whether it's been overruled by Quanta or not. As a matter of patent law, what strikes me as interesting about Mallinckrodt is its potential outcome when sort of patent law is combined with general tort law in distribution of those particular types of products, whether medical devices or the like. A number of courts, one in California, one in Vermont, and one in Alabama, have recently ruled that a brand name manufacturer may be liable for defects in or alleged defects in a generic version of the pill that's been approved to go on the market. If you can't sue generic, you can go after the brand name because they, on the theory that they make the identical pill. And it seems to me that a producer like Mallinckrodt, who was making a single-use device for to take x-rays, maybe using it not just maybe insisting on single use, not just to increase its profits that flow from the patent, but also potentially to reduce liability that may occasion from improper cleaning, improper sterilization, or things like that. And additionally, to the extent that there's any of those incidents happen, also potential reputational damage that may accrue. So if the court is willing to hold brand name companies liable for sins of the generics, one might imagine a situation where a court in one of those states will also hold liable a company like Mallinckrodt for a product that's been misused. And so not only will there be financial liability, but also reputational damage. And so in those situations, perhaps restrictive licenses make sense, and if perhaps when viewed from that angle, the court may or at least should be more tolerant of licenses like that, where they try to protect not just their patent rights and not just sort of exceed the scope of their patent rights, but also try to protect their overall company integrity and integrity of their overall products. So perhaps viewed from that angle, Mallinckrodt should survive and in fact maybe somewhat thrive, but I am not sure that this Supreme Court is willing to read Mallinckrodt broadly to the extent that they are willing to read it at all. So with that, I think I'll pass it along to Hans, and I look forward to more discussion.
Well, thank you. So this is the first time I speak for the Federalist Society. Thank you very much for having me. I'm Hans Sauer. I'm Deputy General Counsel for IP for the Biotechnology Industry Organization. And for those of you who don't know BIO, we are the world's largest trade association for biotechnology. And part of biotechnology, of course, is agricultural biotech. All the big ag biotech companies in the United States are members of BIO, but ag biotech is not the only constituent of biotechnology, right? We have a lot of other companies that make research tools, that make therapeutics or vaccines and the like, all of which are unified, I think, by the use of biotechnology and by certain similarities in their business models. This case got a lot of interest from a lot of different biotech companies, not just the agricultural companies. And we can talk a bit why that is. First, though, I want to tell you that we didn't see this case coming at all when it ended up in the Supreme Court. The first time the industry got wind of this case, if you will, was when early last year the Supreme Court asked for the Solicitor General's office for the views of the United States. Right? That's when alarm bells went off and people called in and said, what's going on? We thought this question had long been decided, the question of replanting second-generation seed, whether that's patent infringement or not. All right, that had been in the Federal Circuit multiple times before in cases with names like Scruggs and McFarling. And so this case seemed very much like that, you know, from at least superficial inspection by people in the industry who looked at the facts of what was going on. Here was a farmer who bought authorized seed from Monsanto, grew a first generation of soybeans in his field, harvested, drove into the grain elevator, sold his crop, then drove round the back and bought some of these beans right back and planted them. How is that different from saving seeds right away? Right? No big difference there from at least the perspective of biotech companies who looked at the case. Nonetheless, when the case ended up in the Supreme Court, when it was taken, there was, I would say, a lot of angst in the industry. First, for the obvious reasons that the case seemed to threaten well-established licensing and sales practices in the agricultural biotech industry, but also that the case implicated the business models, the value capture models of other kinds of biotech companies that sell products that are equally replicable, right, that carry in themselves the instructions and the ability to make more of themselves. You can think of companies that sell preparations of DNA molecules, vectors, and the like for research use, that sell bacterial preparations, that sell vaccines, and the like. So biotech is replete with products that are a little bit like seed in the sense that you can make more of it if you know how it's not particularly hard. In addition, there were quite a number of biotech companies that sell products that aren't as easily replicable, but that sell them, for example, instruments and laboratory chemicals under conditions that look a little bit like the conditions that Monsanto attached to the sale of its seeds, right? There are a lot of biotech companies, and you heard it earlier, that sell products, for example, for single use only, for research use only, not for resale, right? And the price of these products in each case reflects the value of the use as well as the restrictions that comes with it. So, you know, there were a lot of moving parts, a lot of different kinds of companies were interested, saw their own implications in the case, and that, you know, made it both very interesting to brief, BioFile to brief in this case, and very complicated to consider all the implications for the different kinds of biotech companies. At the end of the day, when the case was decided, it was a maybe in retrospect not so surprising, but at very first, you know, it was a little bit surprising to see how short and uncomplicated the opinion was. The court, in its own words, said that they granted certiorari to, quote, consider the important question of patent law raised in this case. Importance, okay, we agree with that, but what question actually are they talking about? What was it that got their attention in this case? Right? One can only wonder. It is true, the case really doesn't explore the conditional sale doctrine at all. And that's at first what we thought that Bio was, what got the Supreme Court's attention. The Supreme Court, we thought, may have felt that they left unfinished business on the table when they decided the Quanta case a couple of years ago. Right, and now in this case, barely a mention of the conditional sale doctrine. We think rightly so, because the Federal Circuit in its decision below didn't rely on the Mallinckrodt doctrine. And in fact, you know, as far as the conditional sale doctrine goes, you know, there are parts in the opinion that made me wonder whether the Supreme Court even views the seed sales practices in this case and elsewhere in the industry as conditional sales at all, or whether this is something else, whether this is a simple issue of a product that's sold with a label license and you stick to the license, and when you breach the license, that's patent infringement. Maybe it's as simple as that, as far as the Supreme Court is concerned. We're not quite sure. At the end of the day, though, we think the opinion was, I think, most notable in how pragmatic it was. And to give you one example, how pragmatic the opinion was in the point where the Supreme Court addressed what I thought was Bowman's punchiest argument in the case, right? To paraphrase, one of the things that Bowman argued was, Bowman said, under Monsanto's theory of this case, farmers pay good money for expensive and sophisticated seed that's only good for planting, and then when they do plant it, they can only grow the seed into soybeans through Monsanto's good graces and not as a matter of right. That's wrong, says Bowman. Right? And I thought it was ably argued. I expected that question to get more play. It had a certain punch in my view. And the court gets to this, and the court goes, well, you know, as a practical matter, that's neither here nor there. Farmers can and do plant these seeds, and Monsanto couldn't stop them from doing so if it tried. As a practical matter, no sane farmer would buy seed if Monsanto were to try and stop them from growing it. Right? So, you know, it's all very simple. It comes out in the wash as a matter of commercial practice. That's what Justice Kagan seems to say. Monsanto sells these things. They come with a sticker license. We don't care whether farmers grow these seed as of right, or only under permission by Monsanto. They grow them for one generation, and if they grow subsequent generations, then they make more seed, and that's just like making more widgets. It seems very simple. So to get to that point, before I wrap up, that certainly was one thing and one central issue in the case that the court really was clear about, and that was of great concern to biotech. The court said that making widgets, making things, patented things, just isn't exhausted by an authorized sale of another patented thing. Right? If you buy a widget, and if you really want two, then you have to buy another one. You can't just buy one and replicate it in your own barn or where else. You know, that's just as simple as that. The only past instances, to talk a little bit about the past cases in the Supreme Court that the court also quoted, the only past instances that we're aware of where making a patented thing was held to be exhausted under the patent doctrine were instances where the patentee itself had sold the specialty components or the unfinished precursor of the patented thing that somebody made, right? So in other words, if I sell the blank for a patented eyeglass lens, right, then I can't complain if somebody uses that thing that's only good for making patented eyeglass lenses and finishes the lens into the finished article, right? Or if I sell a specialized computer component that's only good for assembling into the finished patented machine, then I can't complain if somebody actually assembles the computer with the parts I sold him, right? So these were situations where the sale of the article by the patent owner, if the sale had been done by another, that would have triggered contributory infringement liability, and because in these instances the patent owner himself sold the components, sold the kit, sold the unfinished lens blank, you know, and which was then used in precise conformity with what it was intended for. In those instances, we allow people to make, and in those instances, we will say that the making is exhausted, you know, because these are just instances where the patent owner, in effect, had already sold the widget. It's just meant to be finished, and that was all. So, to our mind, you know, that reconciles the quanta and the universe lens cases, the past exhaustion cases, with this whole issue of making. And we think it kind of fits together. The Supreme Court could perhaps have explicated it a bit better. But as a matter of legal doctrine, I think there's not a lot of tension in this case to our mind. Certainly, like to finish, the biotech industry did breathe a sigh of relief when we read this opinion. The case did implicate long-established sales and licensing practices, which now got, you know, if not the seal of approval, at least a nod from the Supreme Court saying that there's nothing particularly wrong with what agricultural biotech companies have been doing for a long time. The Supreme Court did acknowledge that there were peculiarities in the value capture that attaches to, quote, self-replicating products, but that these peculiarities don't justify an exception in patent law for these kinds of technologies. Patent law operates, and exhaustion law operates, in quite the same way, despite the fact that there are certain challenges in capturing the value of these things. So with that,
Hans, I think we have to move on to our Q&A session.
Yeah, and I'm done. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, so now we can move on to our discussion portion. I would ask Dean if he has opened up the lines and if there are any questions coming in. If not, I have some moderated questions. But I'd ask Dean first if there are questions coming in.
Sure. Hold on and let me open it up for questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. If you're one of our callers, after that, if you have a question, you'll push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So hold on one second. So once again, if you have a question for any of our experts on today's call, you'll push the star button and then the pound button. Our telephone lines are open at this point. We don't have any questions pending. Oh, we have one question pending. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your phone. Professor O'Connor, should we go to the first question?
Yes.
All right, here we go.
Hi, this is Sancho McCann, a society member from Vancouver in Canada. My question is, given that Monsanto's patent rights with respect to making are not exhausted, does Monsanto even need such a complicated technology agreement now, restricting the use of the second generation suit? The opinion seems to say that but for Monsanto's license accompanying the first sale, even the first planting and sale to the elevators would be infringing. So can they now greatly simplify their technology agreement and simply rely on their patent rights?
Yes, I think, you know, that's an interesting question that comes out of the case, and it has to do with, and I'll want to turn it over to George about the innocent infringer, because I think that it also means that the person who has seeds blown onto their land has no real defense, and the person who's not Bowman, you know, Hans points out that from his opinion, Bowman essentially drives around to the back of the grain elevator and buys his seeds back. But what about a farmer who buys seeds from the elevator and never had bought any seeds from Monsanto and so had never been under one of the technology license agreements? So the question then is, it sounds like potentially from the court's decision here that Monsanto doesn't really need to worry about their use. It's covered, it's infringing, so the license may not be needed. George, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I suppose that the license is needed because I think what the questioner is suggesting is that without the license, all you can do with that bag of seeds is eat them, cook them, or, you know, feed them to your animals. You actually can't plant them and make a new generation of seeds. And so you need the license. You need a permissive license, not a restriction in the license. You need a permissive license, I think Justice Kagan is saying, in order to do that. And obviously Monsanto wants people to plant their seeds to grow crops of soybeans, right? They're not just selling feed seeds. There are lots of commercial practices that came out in this case that I think many of us learned for the first time, right? And one question that's along the same lines is, well, why did Monsanto let farmers sell these seeds to grain elevators, you know, so that this mischief could occur in the first place? And again, the answer is, it's a commercial reality. Monsanto could have restricted that right to sell to grain elevators in their seed tag license, but they couldn't, and farmers needed to do this. You need those seeds in the elevator. You know, farmers have to make a living, and you can't strangle your customers completely with, you know, even if you have the right to do so. So I suspect the licenses will continue to be necessary, even though I agree that the patent rights, the default patent rights, are quite strong now, stronger than one might have expected. And, that is a problem for the windblown seeds also, I think.
Greg, do you have any comments on that?
Sure. So I guess I would agree that the license, my reading of the case is the license, so the restrictive license is not particularly necessary. In terms of whether there's a permissive license that's needed, I'm not quite sure that that's needed either. I think the opinion says that, as Hans mentioned, that, you know, any farm would be crazy to buy these seeds from Monsanto if there was not an expectation implied in that initial purchase of planting at least one year worth of crops. So I think that the Monsanto to farmer, Monsanto authorized dealer to farmer, however that sale is accomplished, I think that initial sale, there's an implied license to plant and harvest. And for the second, to get from first generation seeds to the second generation seeds. But there's no such implied license from second to third generation seeds whether or not a restrictive license exists. So in my view, I don't think the Monsanto really needs the restrictive license following this decision, nor do they need an explicit permissive license, because I think that's the court says that's implied. So,
I'm not sure, Greg, that the court does say it's implied. I mean, the fact that it would be crazy commercially doesn't necessarily mean that as a patent law matter you have the implied license. And I think Justice Kagan sidesteps that question by saying there was an express license grant for the second generation of seeds. So what if it weren't soybeans, but what if they were apples, right? Things that most people would eat, right, as opposed to plant to make more patented apple trees. Then it doesn't become quite so obvious that you should just be able to go plant them. And, you know, if they were patented apples, you probably do need a license from the patent holder in order to, you know, create that second generation.
Well, so I think the way I would answer it is that what isn't obvious in terms of what kind of license was implied, I think is inherent in the transaction. And so I think if Monsanto were selling apples in a local, you know, 7-Eleven or any other sort of supermarket, I think perhaps you would be right that there is no implied license to take those apples from the store and then, you know, pick out the core and then plant the seeds. On the other hand, if the sale is if the sale is to commercial farmers who grow apple trees, then I think such a license would be implied. So I think, as with every other sort of contractual matter, what's implied in transactions is fact-bound and fact-specific. And obviously, perhaps I suppose that farmers who want to, you know, belt and suspenders and protect themselves from liability for infringement may want to actually have an explicit license. But I don't think that, again, looking at all the facts surrounding a particular transaction, I don't think it's necessarily required.
Well, let's again be clear, too, that the seeds being sold by Monsanto as first generation are being sold as at a premium. They're not being sold at a price, at the commodity price, at which you would then buy them and eat them. So I think that's the extra wrinkle here, and it sort of is a midway point between what George and Greg are saying. Hans, what's your perspective on this?
It seemed to me, as I was reading the opinion, that the court may very well feel that the license actually is important, right? I thought one of the most interesting pieces about the opinion was footnote 3, where Justice Kagan makes reference to the existence of an explicit license, and she says, you know, if it were to occur that some farmer buys from Monsanto in an authorized sale seed, but there's no explicit license, she said that such a license would be implied in that situation, even though that situation is not very likely to occur. If it were to happen, there would imply one. So that tells me that the court maybe, you know, does feel that the license is important, so important that they're willing to imply one and actually say it in the opinion.
Dean, are there any more questions coming in?
Yes, we do have one question pending at this point. If you want to join the queue as a caller, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone after this next question. Our lines will be open. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Yes, it's David Emerson, society member and patent attorney here in Berkeley, California. You know, a couple of questions, if I might. One focusing less on the terms of the license and more, and just at the precise point at which patent exhaustion ends, whether any of the panelists have a sense of where the court would come out on that sort of continuum between where you just the basic use of the bean, consumption directly, or at various stages beyond that. For example, sprouted beans. Sprouted beans are well on their way to the next generation. Or for even further example along that lines, greens which are harvested before they are ready to produce seed, but are also useful as a foodstuff, again, further along that continuum, or all the way up to the point of potentially commercial viability for the next generation of seed, but prior to the point where itself it could be harvested for seed. And then the second question, if I could, is that since it's sort of a matter of genetic engineering to create traits that are viable generation after generation that are inherited, and it's certainly possible to have traits that are generation skipping or traits that are not expressed in the next generation, isn't Monsanto's failure to create a product which itself is limiting by not expressing that trait in future generations, as a matter of patent policy, should the court be stepping in to help Monsanto out for what really ought to be a problem it could solve itself?
Yeah, so let me restate those a little bit, if I may. I think we all agree, and the court seems to believe, that there is exhaustion. It still applies somehow, and it applies to use. And the question then is, well, what kind of use? And we have the sense that, well, people could eat the beans, the first-generation beans they buy from Monsanto. I've suggested that doesn't really make any sense because they're so expensive. They're clearly not being sold for that purpose. So we get the sense that exhaustion does have to apply to some other kinds of use. And so your question then is, how far along the chain of development of the first-generation seeds does that go before the exhaustion ends, and then under George's view of the permissive license, that then the permissive license picks up. That's question number one. Question number two is the issue of why didn't Monsanto put in generation skipping, or what sometimes is referred to as terminator genes, into their GMO seeds that would then be a kind of technology self-help that would keep the genes from the seeds from replicating further. Let's take the first question first. George, what are your thoughts about where exhaustion ends?
Right. So if we take for given that it's only the bean that Monsanto sells in the bag to which exhaustion applies, then that's where exhaustion ends, right? The, you know, Monsanto didn't patent a bean. I mean, despite, the, you know, that's what we're speaking about. It's not a bean that's patented. It's a gene. It rhymes with bean, but it's different. It's a gene. So as soon as the, you know, the reproduction occurs, right, whether it's a sprouter, I have no idea what you call this in, you know, plant terms, like an embryo of a gene, of the bean. As soon as the next thing, the next incarnation of the plant that has the Monsanto Roundup-resistant gene in it is produced, that is making the patented product, I would think. And so I think...
isn't the bean the product? The next second-generation bean is really the product, and that comes from a much later process.
Well, so right. So where is it just, where is it a bean, and where is it just a spark in the eye of the parent bean, right? I think it's pretty early in the bean gestation process that you have something that could be considered a patented bean that contains the patented gene.
I mean is that you don't get the beans in the initial sprout, or even in the initial plant. It takes at some point of maturity until then the second generation beans actually start to form. So there's been replication of a bean.
What I'm saying, though, is that the DNA, I mean, it's all the same plant, right? The DNA that's in the cellular nuclei of the leaves and the stalk is the same DNA that's in the bean, and they're all Roundup resistant. Right, I mean, it's the resistance to glyphosate that is the patented characteristic here, and I, you know, again, maybe Greg, who has a stronger biology background than I have, can answer more specifically, but I also think the kill switch idea is a very real one, and you know, it's certainly something that is biologically possible. My suspicion is it's just more expensive, riskier, you know, again, these are things that people eat. Every genetic modification that's made, I think Monsanto wants to be very, very careful about. So including something that switches off, you know, the glyphosate resistance after one generation, I assume it's just another variable that, you know, you'd rather not put in if you can avoid it. But that's just a guess.
Okay, George. So great. So your view then is that as soon as the, let's say, any replication of the DNA, which would include any additional cells, right, that are being generated out of the seed, which would then include the sprouts and whatnot, that then those are essentially a making, because the claim is on the DNA, not the overall seed. So, Greg, what are your views on this?
Well, first, I suppose I should hedge my bets until a Myriad comes out and we, you know, will know what exactly it means to, you know, to have a patent on the gene. But that aside, I think that's right, and ultimately, I think in some ways, as a matter of patent law, it doesn't matter. I mean, I'm sure. Again, going back to my, I know it's an imperfect analogy, but going back to it, sure, a car company, whoever has a patent on that particular type of engine, could avoid making the engine with nuts and bolts so they can be disassembled, and could use you know, sort of a more permanent assembly such as welding so that you really can't take it apart. But I don't see why they should have to. I mean, if they come up with a new innovation that they get a patent on it, I don't see why they should be required to build particularly strong fences and defenses around their product just to absolutely make sure that people don't do things they're not supposed to do in the first place. So could it be easier ultimately for Monsanto if they do put in such terminator genes into their products? Perhaps at some point technology will be such that putting those genes will be both safe and effective and cheaper than actually policing what farmers do down the line and bringing suits, which are not inexpensive, and, you know, getting experts and filing, you know, and paying filing fees and so on. But I don't think that they have to. I think if they want to, if they want to enforce through the judicial system the rights that have been properly granted to them, and, you know, there's, in this case, there's been no indication or no argument that the patent is somehow invalid or improper or is improperly procured, they should be free to do it, whether they're producing seeds or engines or, electronics or whatever else.
Now, Greg, perhaps I missed it, but did you answer the exhaustion ends part of that? So do you agree with George that it's as soon as the bean starts doing anything, essentially, that the exhaustion is done?
I don't know what anything means. I suppose that while the – let me put it this way. I think exhaustion ends when the beans – the first-generation beans completes what a first-generation bean is supposed to do. So whether it's sprouting or producing the second generation beans, up until you get to the second generation bean, and the first generation bean is all used up. Whether it's to grow beans or to, some people may wish to plant it to, for example, adjust soil pH or to whatever it is that the first generation bean is supposed to do. Once all of that is done, I think that's when exhaustion ends.
Okay, so a little different from George. Hans, what about you on the question of when exhaustion ends and on the kind of terminator gene issue?
Yeah, on the when exhaustion ends, I think if we were to take a very pragmatic approach, like what the Supreme Court did here, you know, we could look back to what the Supreme Court said in cases like Quanta, where it said, look, you know, exhaustion includes that which is embodied in the article that you're selling, right? So you're selling something, and it embodies something, and if whatever it is embodied is patented, you know, that should be exhausted. Okay, so that doesn't, like, totally answer it, but if I were a farmer and I would look at a 50-pound bag of seeds, you know, which I bought, and I know that that's good for seeding, say, 0.8 acres, I would say, well, that's what that bag embodies, right? It's an acre of soybeans in my field. And I plant those, and they grow, and, you know, here I am. It embodies an acre of soybeans. That's when exhaustion maybe ends. That would be like my belt and suspenders kind of answer. Real quick on the creating traits that disappear after generations. Yes, Monsanto, you know, has worked for a while on that kind of technology, so-called terminator or whatever you might want to call it, technology. But at the end of the day, there were two impediments to that. One is, you know, you've got to keep in mind consumer acceptance. So there's a real question whether that really benefits agriculture if you breed in and develop traits that don't increase productivity, that don't increase yields or pest and disease resistance, but that are put in there only for other commercial purposes to protect what otherwise needs to be protected by patents, right? It seems kind of silly to invest a lot of research dollars and regulatory approval dollars into that when you should be investing your money and stuff that makes your crops grow better. And at the end of the day, if the patents can take care of that question, we're much better off without having to spend development dollars on that kind of technology and spend it on stuff that makes our crops grow better.
Okay, well, great. Dean, I think that we don't have time for any more questions since we're just about at the hour. Are there any things you need to do to wrap up this call formally?
No, I just want to thank all the participants and thank our audience for joining us today, and invite our audience to consult the Federalist Society website for an upcoming schedule of our upcoming Teleform conference calls.
Great. So then if that's everything, then I want to thank everyone, the panelists especially, for their participation, and I want to thank the listeners who have tuned in for this, and we hope that you all check out and ask more questions, and we'll see where all this develops in the future.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.